Well, I guess you might have changed it to relaxation and slow aging. Maybe that's, that goes together. But these are just buzzwords which are used in this field of physics, and I'm not responsible for them. This is a piece of work that was done by the PhD student is Ariel Amir. He's a fantastic guy. And Yuval Oreg is an associate professor at my institute. We were looking for something which for us would be a little bit unusual outside of our ordinary field of interest, and this is a good one. So what is this? What I'm going to tell you about is really like digging a small hole in a corner of a really huge problem. The huge problem is the problem of the glass phase. The glass phase is a very difficult problem of condensed matter physics. And there are many, many fundamental questions associated with it, which we really do not know how to answer. Whether there is a transition or not, whether it's equilibrium or not, or what kind of non-equilibrium, and what exactly happens. Very, very difficult questions, and this question, by the way, has been with us. I'm not going to give you the whole spiel and show you pictures of of Chinese old glasses, but the glass phase has been known for thousands of years. And, mankind would really like to understand this phase. And it's, as I said, it's very difficult. And there are a couple of variations of that thing. And I think we found one which at least presents some simple things that you can do and learn some things which I hope will be useful also for the bigger problem. So what are the common features to these things which are not very well understood? There is, of course, randomness. There is what is called frustration, that the interactions among different molecules are not exactly compatible with each other. Each one drives it towards a different place. There are many, many quasi-equilibrium states close to the ground state. Then there is a host of measurable things that people do, and for some of them they invented names such as aging. Aging in this connection is a very specific meaning, which I'll explain and show you in detail towards the end of the talk. Now, the physical examples for glasses are ordinary glasses, like window glass, lot of magnetic spin glasses, etc. You can get it on the computer by taking of hard spheres. And I'll talk about the fourth one, which is the glass, which is just a purely electronic state. It's a glass-like phase, which formed out of electrons in insulating systems. I'll explain it in a minute. Here there is an advantage, the interactions are long range. However, they are not infinite range, so it doesn't really justify some of the common models for that. And this is the problem that we are going to study. We are just going to concentrate on this particular thing. It in some sense is simpler, in other senses it may be as difficult, if not more. And the general questions that we are going to address are, what is the structure of the eigenstates of this system, first? And then, what is much more difficult is the out-of-equilibrium behavior. What are the dynamics of this system? You perturb the system, you want to know how it flows towards, a more desirable state, say, flow of free energy. We were motivated by experiments. These experiments are done in a few labs in the world. Two notable ones are Tzvi Ovadiahu, our colleague in the Hebrew University, Jerusalem. And then there is a good group at Grenoble, France, and there are more. And what is common to these electronic glasses is that when you perturb them and then watch how they return to the state at which they were before, this decay is very often logarithmic in time. This is the result from a sample of indium oxide sample. Indium oxide is very interesting. You know, by the way, that the oxides really give you a lot of interesting possibilities, from high TCs, which are oxides, to vanadium oxide, which gives you metal insulator transitions. And this one is a very interesting material for many aspects too. And you see that the conductance, which is an easily measurable quantity of the system, decays logarithmically with time. Over here, it's, I would say, 5, 6 decades. Here it's from seconds to a few days. And this logarithmic decay is very interesting, and we would like to try to understand it. Here is, by the way, another system, totally different system. It's aluminum granules inside an oxide. And again, the same kind of experiment is done here, but it's a little bit less clear, but nevertheless, it's, you see that on the logarithmic scale, it looks pretty straight. So this is an interesting feature. We would like to try to understand it. That's the motivation. There are two other motivations. One is the experiment is called aging, a very interesting one. It will not help you at all towards your individual aging problem, but that's what they call aging, and I'll explain it in great detail in about half an hour. The other one is, it's called in this business the two deep experiment. And it's really beautiful. You prepare the system in some metastable state. You perturb it. You measure the conductance. You see a minimum. Then you change some parameter, which I'll explain in a minute. You get to another state. There is yet another minimum. Now you start waiting hours and days and more. And you see that this, when you wait this in the beginning, you still have almost only the original thing. And then this starts to decrease, and this starts to increase. And you slowly, slowly move from the non-equilibrium states characterizing this thing to the one characterizing that thing. So they call it the two deep one. And this, we don't have an explanation for yet, but this is our next problem. And now what is the parameter which is varied here? Actually, this is a very nice handle, which really makes these systems good to study. This is called the gate voltage. And I'm sure you heard about it in all sorts of talks about the quantum Hall effect and things like that. If your system is, for example, this yellow thing, you put a metallic gate near it and you change the voltage. And by doing that, since this system is an insulator, it's quite easy to charge this capacitor and change the density of charge carriers in your system. So it's a very convenient handle. But turning a knob, you change the electron density, hole density in your system. So this is a convenient parameter. And with this parameter, with temperature, with the way the sample is prepared, with the chemistry of the sample, you can really do a lot of experimental studies. And those were done and are being done. I didn't notice. Yeah, okay. It happens. Nobody is perfect. The basic model, now, I'm sure some of you will ask me, what about, is it a quantum calculation or a classical calculation? The answer is that the quantum mechanics is very important to establish the basic model, the basic features of the system. But once you define them, from a certain point on, it becomes, you can use classical physics, and that's what we are going to do next. But the basic model is that you have localized electronic states. Now, electrons in the system can sit. The wave function is non-zero. Psi square is only non-zero at a certain range of the system. So there is one here, and one there, and one there. So imagine that the x-axis is space coordinate, and the y-axis is the energy coordinate. So, you know, they are localized at different points in space, but the energy, each of them is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, is different. Now, how does the system relax? The system sits, for example, in this state, this energy and this point in space. It would like to relax to that state. How will it do it? It must exchange some energy with the outside reservoir. In this case, the most natural one is the phonons, the vibration modes of the system. So it emits a phonon, and by that, it can go from that state to that state. This is relaxation. It's the opposite process to what you need sometimes in order to move the electron. If you want to create conductivity, you want to take the electron, which is sitting conveniently here, and get it up there by actually absorbing a phonon. And these two processes are slightly different two factors, which I'll write down in a minute. And this is what determines the conductance of the system. Now, these localized states are only part of the rules of the game for the model that we are going to talk about. The other part is the electron-electron Coulomb interactions. Those Coulomb interactions are simply there because whether you do or you do not have an electron filling a localized state, changes the charge of that area, and then there are Coulomb interactions among those. And Efros and Shklovsky, some years ago, found a very interesting argument, and the first part of which is absolutely correct and clean, to show that in this case, the single electron density of states of this system has a gap right at the Fermi energy. And the way that they show it is that they evaluate the cost to move an electron from state I to state J. Now, you know, each of them is interacting with all the other electrons, and when it moves, this interaction gets subtracted. So we have to do it carefully, and then you find that to move an electron from I to J costs EI minus EJ. Sorry, that's from J to I. But you also have to subtract from it this Coulomb interaction as if it were I and J. This is what you obtain after summing everything. Now, if you are in a ground state or in a locally stable state of the system, this delta E must be zero. And since this is a finite number, it means that there is some limit on this difference. When you work it out, you find that there cannot be the number of states close to zero energy, which is the Fermi energy. Fermi energy is zero excitation energy. Number of these states has to go to zero with the difference from the Fermi energy. And this goes like, the density of states goes like the energy to a power b minus 1, where d is the number of dimensions. This part of the argument is absolutely clean. Then it goes further, and that can be debated. But I'm not going to need that, so I will not go into that. This effect has a certain characteristic energy, which is pretty large. It's just Coulomb energy at the nearest neighbor distance. And you might wonder whether this is seen experimentally, and it is. It's actually quite strong, and you know, people can measure this density of states by tunneling experiments, and they see it here. This is, by the way, a very nice experiment, because here they changed the parameter, which took the system from the metallic phase to the insulator phase, and here you have a little dip. Again, everything happens at the Fermi energy. And some of you may know this is called the Altshuler-Aronov anomaly. And it increases, and then it joins with this, this is so-called Coulomb gap, once you get into the insulator. So this is the kind of thing that you observe. And I'm showing it to you because part of the task of a theory is to reproduce this. So that was the beginning of the sort of introduction and motivation. Now, what is the simplest way to think about this problem? Let's make a kind of mean field approximation for the real energies of those localized states. Each localized state has an energy epsilon I. This is the initial single particle energy that it had. Now, this is also interacting with all the other guys with the Coulomb interaction. So what it is, it's a sum of all the other, the E over R, times 0 or 1, depending on whether there is an electron or not in that site. So what we are going to do is a single step, which is to replace all these FJs by the thermal averages, by just the thermal averages, which are, of course, given by the Fermi function of the energy with respect to the chemical potential that we take to be zero. But notice that it's not averaging over space. It's only for every site, and every site has its own energy, its own epsilon I, its own set of Rijs. For every site, there will be another EI. So it's not homogenizing the system by averaging too much, which our approximations do. It's still retaining the specificity of sites, but for each site, but saying that Fj, as far as interactions with the other site are concerned, is replaced by its thermal average. Now, this approximation may be expected to be actually not so bad, because you know we know from a lot of experience in related matters that such mean field approximations become good when the number of interacting species is large and the interaction is long range. And the Coulomb interaction is pretty long range, so you know, roughly speaking, it shouldn't be a bad approximation. So the first thing to check is to what extent this simple thing reproduces what is known about the system. And the first thing which is known about the system is this Coulomb gap, which I mentioned before. If you take a 2D system, two-dimensional system, where I mentioned to you it should have been e to the power d minus 1, just linear, and you just solve these equations numerically, which is a trifle, it's really very, very easy, and you get the single particle density of states at the Fermi energy, and in fact, it is linear, it goes to zero, just like, so at least in this business, this approximation is not so bad. Then one can check also the temperature dependence. And it's, when you increase the temperature, these Fs are no more so well defined. They are not zero or one, but in between. And interestingly enough, this gap is filled up. And it's filled up in a understandable way. Turns out to be linear in temperature. And it agrees with some ways of analytical ways to look at this problem. So this mean field approximation is doing okay for simple things, for calculating energies, for calculating densities of states. So we feel that at least we have a machine that can handle the simple things. Now let's go to the more difficult question, which is the dynamics of the question, of the problem. And this is now not so controlled approximation, but let's do it and see what it does. So I first of all, I have to remind you how one writes the rate equations for such a system. So what are the rates we are talking about? The rates are the time derivative of the population of a given site. So there are n sites, each of them ni, each of them can change in time. Now why does it change in time? Either because there is a transition from it to another state, or because there is a transition from that state to it, which increases the population and this decreases the population. So this is just the really elementary and simple rate equation governing the dynamics of those occupation numbers. The rates are well known, you know, by general rules and can be calculated to be given as follows. First of all, in order, you know, if I want to go from I to J, I need to have something at I. But since we are talking about electrons, which are fermions, we also need to have an empty place in J, at J. So it must be like that. And you know that if you do the calculation by, for example, the Fermi-Golden rule, you get this. Then you get another interesting factor. Since this is, as I mentioned to you before, these transitions are accomplished by, you know, depending on whether a transition is downward or upward, by emitting or absorbing a boson excitation, a phonon, could also have been a photon in other contexts. Then in order to go down, in order to go up, you must have a photon with the right energy in order to absorb it. In order to go down, you can also go down by spontaneous emission, so you have to add one. So basically, the rule is just this times that times the number of photons, plus one if you talk about emission. These are just the basic rate equations of the system. And actually, solving them gives you what the system will do. Now, why this is not a simple, why the system is already quite complex? Because everything is interacting with everything. And when one electron is moving, it's immediately changing the energies of all the others. And sometimes it can open other decay paths, sometimes it can close the decay path, and so on and so forth. So the equation is quite simple, but the physics behind it is very, very non-trivial. And as a first step, which already led to interesting results, we said, let's go ahead and analyze these rate equations in the linear approximation, just around some local equilibrium state. So what we do is you linearize the equations, and you get an interesting set of linearized equations. And this set of linearized equations, of course, can always be written in matrix form. So you have a vector, which is the vector of populations. And the derivative of this vector of population with respect to time is some matrix times this vector. And this matrix has a lot of elements. And in a minute, I'll talk to you about the eigenvalues of this matrix, which are the issue of this problem. And then you just take the previous equation, linearize it, and you find some interesting expression. And the expression, actually, there is one thing which is non-trivial about it. It has one term which is independent of the Coulomb interaction. It has another term which is proportional to E squared. That's the Coulomb interaction term. And you might think that since this term has 1 over T in front of it, it will be the leading one at low temperatures. But actually, it works exactly the opposite. And I'll first of all motivate it by a simple argument, then show you numerically that it works. Turns out that although this has 1 over T, this term will be the dominant one at low temperatures. The reason is that those NJs and I's go to 1 or 0 as the temperature goes to 0, and they do it exponentially. So the blowing up of this term is more important than the blowing up of that term. So it's a little bit counterintuitive, but you expect the interaction to be important at intermediate temperatures, but become less important at low temperatures. Very, very strange, but you'll see in a minute that this really happens. And we found that the real parts of the eigenvalues are all negative, which is required by the assumption that you started from a metastable state. So, you know, when the word stability, this was prepared about a few months ago, you immediately are reminded of this object, or maybe instability. So I just put it here to remind us some other meaning of the word stability. Now you take this matrix A, which you write, you know, from what I told you, and you put it on a computer and they analyze it. And here are the eigenvalues. This is the eigenvalues as a function of the eigenvalue index. And you see a lot of them. Then there are some small ones. In a minute, we will concentrate on the small ones. The blue curve is just a comparison between what happens with and without the interactions. So the interactions are important at finite temperatures, become less important at low temperatures. All that was checked. But then there was a kind of something that hits you when you look at the results. And what hits you is you find that the eigenvalue spectrum at low real part of lambda, from now on I'll only talk about the real part of lambda, of the eigenvalue, which is negative, means decay, has a distribution which goes like 1 over lambda, 1 over the eigenvalue distribution. So the weak lambdas, you know, the slow decay rates, are more numerous than the fast decay rates. If you think, for example, for a minute, how will the decay of your system behave? You know, you give it some small, you know, start with a small kick, not to go too far, to stay in the linear regime. What you have to do, you have to expand your initial perturbation in the eigenvectors of A, and then each of these eigenvectors will decay by its own lambda. The first one will decay very quickly and are not interesting to us. Then on any time scale for a large system, you will just deal with those lambdas which are on the order of your time scale, of your inverse of your time scale. So for longer and longer time scales, you're going to have still decays, and actually the number of those decay channels will increase when lambda becomes small. So the slow decay is really the rule of the game. Now, if you assume somehow that in a typical perturbation, you know, you excite kind of ergodically with more or less equal weights the eigenvectors, then you'll immediately think that the typical physical quantity, like as delta n of t, you know, will decay according to that distribution, each of them with its own lambda. And you evaluate this integral, lo and behold, you get a log t. with a negative coefficient, which you may remember I showed you is just a typical way measurable quantities behave experimentally. So that really gave us some more motivation to continue in this. Let me just show you, this is the inverse of P of lambda. You see that it's pretty nicely linear in lambda. We'll continue to discuss that. A very interesting result is obtained when you switch the interactions on and off. And I really recommend to look quite carefully at this curve. This is this P, which is, goes like 1 over lambda. And when you switch on the interaction, the small lambda part of the peak goes, it stays the same curve. The curve is not changing, but it's applicable to smaller and smaller lambda. So what this thing tells you is really the crux of the matter. It tells you that somehow this 1 over lambda is the dominant behavior. And when you, if you just could switch on the interaction will just push you to smaller and smaller values. Where this will hold will go to smaller and smaller values as the complexity of the system becomes larger when it's interacting more strongly. Let me just finish the sentence, please. So when you see this, you say to yourself, hey, maybe what is happening here is that this 1 over lambda is a universal behavior, and more complex, and I'll give you some examples later, more complex systems simply show it at longer and longer timescales. So this is kind of the paradigm that we are aiming at, and I'd like to continue discussing it from now on. Please. You have to assume that you are stable for the non-interaction calculation. It should be. I mean, the check is the eigenvalues. Had you had one positive eigenvalue, the thing would fly off. So it so happens that you start with a state without the interactions. You let it evolve. You get this spectrum. You switch on the interactions on the same state. You still get 1 over lambda. So at least switching on interactions retains the 1 over lambda, but pushes it. The important thing is it pushes it to smaller values. Why smaller values? Because these interactions come in your way. When you want to move something, you have to pay interaction energy. That's the way.
I think one should think about it.
So this is one interesting lesson. And all this is very, very simple, but I think the interesting lesson is something which has to be kept in mind. Now, at that stage, we were reminded of an older paper by our chairman, and Parisi and Mezar, which looked at something which they call distance or Euclidean matrices. And those matrices are actually, quite a close relative of our matrices, just matrices where you put points, random points on some piece of space, and you say that you take a random matrix whose elements are exponentials of the random distance between two points divided by some characteristic length. And they actually did a very sophisticated and good job in evaluating the eigenvalue spectrum of such matrices. And we said to ourselves, we really want this thing at low densities. Low density means that the motion really goes on in very, very specific points in the system, which are getting further and further from each other as the relaxation gets smaller. So what is the eigenvalue spectrum of such matrices? So first of all, if you take their result and just evaluate them, and here we did it in 1 and 2D, at the low density limit, you get 1 over lambda in 1D, and you get almost 1 over lambda, 1 over lambda with logarithmic corrections in 2D. And this is the P of lambda, points are numerical, curve is this result, and agrees, I think, quite beautifully. Now, turns out you can make a back-end envelope heuristic calculation which will reproduce the same results. And why? How do you get into that calculation? There is a ubiquitous thing in physics which is called 1 over F noise. It has already been mentioned here recently in some talks. 1 over F noise is the well-known aspect of 1 over F noise is that you take a conducting system, or even a poorly conducting system, if you could measure its conductivity as function of time, you would find that the conductivity is changing. So if you put a voltage and you measure the current, this current is fluctuating. You analyze the power spectrum of this, you find 1 over frequency. That has been, the principle of it has been explained, I think, in 1937 by a guy called Bernamot, who said, I'll very naturally get a 1 over lambda distribution of rates if I assume that the rates are negative exponential of a quantity, of some barrier, which is distributed uniformly. Therefore, the log of the rate will be distributed uniformly. And of course, you can then, if the log of the rate is uniform, what is the rate? The rate goes like 1 over, the P of the rate is 1 over the rate. So this is supposed to be the explanation of 1 over F, and it probably arises in all these disordered systems by things jumping, moving against some barriers, which are always more or less uniformly distributed. Turns out, of course, that this uniform distribution of the log makes connection with something that I think more mathematically oriented people know, and I don't think they love it, but it's there, and that's called the Benford law. The Benford law says that if you have random collections of stuff, that stuff in this table, which you cannot read, but I'm not sure you really want to read it, that is the table of the distances between some city in Texas with all the other cities in the US. And those distances, the log of those distances is distributed uniformly. If you take the numbers in your income tax return, if you have one, and you see the distribution, the log of those numbers is distributed like uniform. Now, why is that? It turns out it can, and I really don't want to go into this. The reason is that since the distribution of a number doesn't depend on the system, whether it's binary, decimal, 7, 8, 10, then there is a kind of scale invariance. And from this scale invariance, you can show that the distribution of the log is uniform. And therefore, for example, you know that the probability to get 1 is the first figure of a random number is not 1/10, it's about 30%. So it's more likely to get 1 in a set of random numbers than to get 8. And it's more likely to get 2 than to get 8. So it goes like some log. So actually, this Benford distribution, again, assumes, and then people looked at all sorts of other random numbers and found that this 1 over the number is a quite a general thing, and its meaning is just such that if you're, the thing that you are looking at is the exponential of a negative quantity which is uniform, then automatically you're going to get this. Now, once you understand that, you immediately understand, first of all, you get immediately a very cheap derivation of this 1 over lambda distribution. And second, you understand why it's not unreasonable to expect it to be universal. Consider, for example, a much more complicated process, a process where, you know, you have a two-particle relaxation, something I didn't discuss. So this one goes down and this one goes up. So, you know, the total energy system went up a little bit in this process. This is a very complicated process. It's possible to calculate it by fourth-order perturbation theory in the electron-buff coupling, and it has a certain rate. But again, the main thing about this process will be exponential. And once it's exponential, and once the exponent, there is no reason to expect the exponent to have any structure. So if it's more or less uniform, and by the way, it does not have to be uniform on a large interval, because because it's small numbers which are exponents of large numbers, the large numbers today constant within 50 or 20%, maybe all depends on how large it is, it's not already enough to establish 1 over lambda, 1 over f behavior of a large f scale. So with just the wonderful properties of logarithmic functions or exponential functions, it gives you all that. This is, by the way, this complicated thing. And the speculation is that if you now take this simple model where only one electron moves, and now let two, three, and so on, you will still have each of them will still have more or less a 1 over lambda distribution. The constant may change, and this is something to which we cannot really say very much yet. But the 1 over lambda is really believed to be quite a universal property here. Now, I just owe you one more explanation, which is quite easy. The experiments I talked about were measuring the conductivity. I talked to you about the set of occupations of those localized levels. Why one is connected with the other? The reason is very clear. If you go to zero temperature, you have a certain set of ends, and there the conductivity is zero. Zero temperature, all these hopping conductivities are zero. Making delta ends which are not non-equilibrium, it's very much like having a characteristic temperature which is higher than zero, and therefore the conductance would be larger, and it would be larger, presumably a linear function of those delta n i. The delta n i's themselves are exponential in temperature, but the conductance should be a linear functional, and that immediately will give you a log of the conductance too. Having talked about the conductance, I'd like also to say, I will not dwell too much on it, but you can use this mean field model, this is yet unpublished work, to look at a steady state, to put a finite voltage, and this has been done by Miller and Abrams many, many years ago, and evaluate the conductance, and we have done this very, very easy. And we tried to apply it to the question of the hopping conductivity in this model. And I really don't want to go into details of this because I think I promised people to talk about their aging. Their means in the aging of the NI, not of you or me. I just say that in experiment there are two kinds of behaviors that are observed. Can be e to the minus t to the 1 over dimension plus 1 or 1 over half. And actually this trivial approximation manages to get this crossover in a beautiful way. This is the calculation of this Miller-Abrams network. And you see that at high temperatures, it's the non-interacting result at low temperatures. This really works very well. Now I want to go to this aging thing. What is called aging in the glass literature is really a very interesting protocol, which I think the beauty of it is that it immediately tells you that this system is complex and is very, very sluggish, and actually never gets into equilibrium. So the general protocol which is used to define this concept is, let's say that there is a parameter of the system which you can switch by a knob. And actually for our systems, I told you before, what is this parameter? This parameter is a gate voltage. It actually can also be done by optical excitation, but I won't go into it. You have something which you turn and you change the physics of the system. So let's suppose that at time zero, you modify this parameter. So you turn this knob, and let's say you enter the 1% more electrons into your system. So you got to that state. Now you let that state, you sit there for a time, which is called conventionally the waiting time. So you wait a certain time, TW. You expect that after TW, no matter how long TW will be, you have not reached full equilibrium. So what you'll do now is you will turn the system back and watch what happens. I don't like to make analogies with turning back the time on biological aging. That would be much more interesting. So, you know, you start the system at some local equilibrium. These pictures will really tell you now what is happening. You change the local equilibrium parameter. So the system would like to get here. So this guy starts to roll down. As we mentioned before, the rolling down is very, very slow, and actually becomes slower and slower as the time progresses. You do this rolling time within a time TW. You stop after TW. It hasn't really made it to the bottom, but it, you know, it's a sort of advanced a little bit in life. Now you change it back. And you let the guy start to slide back to the original thing that it was. It's as if, you know, you stop now, you turn back the time, and you start to roll back towards your younger age. Seems to be a good proposition. How to treat such a protocol within, assuming now that all these changes are small, and they can all be treated within the linear approximation, how can we treat it within our this eigenvalue thing? Very, very easy. You know, you start here, you let the thing relax. Actually, after TW, roughly speaking, it's a little bit more complicated than that. All the quicker eigenvalues will have relaxed, and all the slower eigenvalues will stay. Now you stop here, you go back. Now actually we relax by the eigenvalues of the new problem, but if the parameter here changed a little, these things have not changed very much. Now it will start again its way, and again it will start from just some situation which is the partial relaxation, the initial state, and from that it will start to relax according to the new set of eigenvalues. And with the assumption that the set of eigenvectors stays roughly the same, or the overlaps are of order unity, you actually derive a formula. And the formula is that this aging will, and then you measure the thing for time t, which is after switching back, you're now waiting to see what happens. And our expectation is that it should go like log of 1 plus the wait time over t. This is the result of this almost trivial calculation. These are the experimental results, just as function of the log. These are the you know, more untreated data which yield this. I think this agreement is too good to be true, and it has two interesting things to it. One, that the aging at short times starts like log, and actually at long time, very interestingly, it goes like 1 over t. This is distinct from the relaxation of the conductance. It's aging, it's a different protocol. And so it has two different limiting behaviors. It crosses over at the waiting time. And the whole thing is, you know, is what happens now after you try to go back to your younger age. The rate that you go back to the younger age depends on how long you stayed in the longer age. This is basically what the glass people call aging, as far as I can understand. But not only that, but not only is it a simple function, but it's a function of the ratio TW over T, and for that there is a name in the glass literature, it's called simple aging. So this particularly trivial model gives you both simple aging and a specific function for this simple aging, which happens to agree very nicely with experiment. So we were quite happy to see that. And I just end, some of you may know Giorgio Parisi, and here there is a caricature by Mark Parisi, and which talks about aging in a slightly different fashion. So I showed it in his birthday. Conclusions. I'll emphasize just the dynamics, because that's really the message that I'd like to convey to you. So we discuss dynamic near a locally stable point in a kind of disorder system characterized by disorder and interactions. The dynamic shows log t relaxations, 1 over lambda distribution of the eigenvalues. And we believe that this is really a an interest, this matrix A that I started with, the relaxation matrix, we believe this is a very general model of a class of random matrices which leads to this distribution. It's very, very different from the ordinary Wigner random matrix. It's another kind of random matrices, but it is a nice class of random matrix. And this class of random matrices should be applicable to the glassy systems. The weakness of all I told you, and I really want to say it, very clearly, is we only discussed relaxation around the metastable state. We did not discuss transitions between metastable states. The intuitive arguments I gave you suggest that since that is also exponentially inhibited, and if those exponents are again uniform in time, that also should be 1 over lambda. And that's really the big expectation that we have. We believe this, but we really can only prove it in very, very simple situations, such as adding the interactions, subtracting the interactions, and so on. Simple calculations on these two particle transitions show also that they have a similar thing, but that's only a very limited thing. But the speculation here is that you can add more features, including the ability to go to metastable states, to other metastable states, to better metastable states, lower free energy, and that will still retain the 1 over lambda, but push it to much, much lower lambda. And the last thing which we are working on right now is this two deep experiment I showed you in the beginning, which we are trying to get from this theory to. Some details can be seen in this paper. There is one or two more coming. Thank you very much. Yes, I said so, yes. That doesn't matter, actually. Because, 1 over lambda is 1 over lambda. So, no, they don't have to be the same. As long as what counts is not, they are a continuum, so it's an integral. So as long as it's 1 over lambda, it's 1 over lambda. Of course, the individual points are moving, but the function is the same. The really non-trivial assumption is that the eigenvectors stay almost the same. So if you go too far, it should not be like that. And actually, that's a kind of prediction. And we can estimate how far you can go for this simple edging to break down. Well, first of all, a finite system, 1 over lambda has a probability, has the unpleasant feature that its integral doesn't converge. So there must be a cutoff. Well, in a finite system, there would be just a finite number of eigenvalues, and that will give you a natural cutoff. But there may be some other cutoffs. Actually, we thought of some other cutoff, but I'm not sure has anything to do with reality. But there is a cutoff. If worse comes to worse, it's just the size. There is an N, which is the number of these guys. Excuse me? Well, I would define it as a separate state of the electronic type of the matter. The matter is, these systems is some kind of crystal, not a crystal, it's some kind of whatever, solid. You want to be careful. This solid has cations, anions, maybe different kinds. Within these solids, there is an electron gas. So this is a glassy state of the electron gas. It's not such a out of this world concept. People have been talking about vortex matter in superconductors. So, you know, it's okay for us theoreticians to talk about some component of the system within a different system and talk about the you know, the states of matter of that guy, of that matter. So this is electronic matter within the ionic matter. That's what it is. Yes, it's the scale invariance of with respect to the unit of measurement. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, I should have said that more clearly. Of course, the original energy is not interesting. The interesting thing is the self-consistent energy, and that energy is changing when you relax. And that's part of the problem. You know, everything is moving. Well, thank you.